Hello and welcome back to another episode of the HRER podcast, where we delve into the world of HR emergencies and scandals. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to HRER on your favourite podcast platform.
Get ready for scandalous stories, lessons learned, and a generous dose of advice for HR professionals for navigating the HR landscape.
Our goal here is not just to entertain, but also to help you learn from the topics we touch on in order to save your business from its own emergency.
Hi Alyssa, I'm seeking your guidance on a probation issue with one of our customer service advisors who has disclosed he's autistic. We're leaning toward not passing his probation, but want to handle this appropriately. Could you please advise?
When we're talking about something that's neurodiverse, it might be that someone can't interpret information in a certain way. Perhaps they might have concentration issues. There's a huge spectrum of challenges that people who are neurodiverse will experience. An employer will ring me up and go, but they're dishonest. They were dishonest when we recruited them because they didn't tell us. Or we sent them a medical form and they didn't put that they had a disability on it. And I go, so?
Just before we start, protect your business from the risk of tribunal, reduce legal costs, and save yourself from HR headaches with our Hero software and employment law consultancy services.
We're back. We're back doing podcasts. You've got your statistics ready, I hope.
It's a bit of a role reversal, this one.
Doing a bit of prep.
I get to do the stats, so you're going to do more talking.
I am, yeah. Well, hopefully so. Today, we're going to talk about a chap who's in the customer service sector, which is something, it's part of my job.
Yeah.
So I've got a little bit on this. Disclosed that he was autistic to his employer and there was a little bit of a fallout from that, I'm led to believe.
Yeah.
I will read the email now.
Let's dive into it because this is a hot topic at the moment.
Let's go. Hi Alyssa, I'm seeking your guidance on a probation issue with one of our customer service advisors who has disclosed he's autistic. He regularly struggles to understand client requests, often saying he doesn't get the task even after clarification, which delays delivery and creates client friction. His role is second line support. He's also working overnight and interpreting tickets in his own way without oversight, meaning the team is coming into angry customer requests that haven't been resolved. We're leaning toward not passing his probation, but want to handle this appropriately. Could you please advise?
This is becoming a bit of a classic scenario. Not around sort of customer service, but just generally where we're seeing a huge increase, either in the disclosure that somebody's got autism, so people are now being much more open about it at work, and other neurodiverse conditions such as ADHD, but very much in the performance management sort of theme of the things that we talk about and we advise on. We're seeing an awful lot of, one, disclosures, and two, new diagnosis, particularly amongst adults. So this is one where the client really struggled. Typically, you know, probation failures, not so much of a big deal, someone not settling in or someone's not quite up to it. Or maybe they've, you know, exaggerated their CV slightly or said they've got more skills or capabilities than they have and it transpires that's not entirely true. We feel pretty comfortable with terminating probations. At the moment, obviously, new regime to come under the Employment Rights Bill. We don't know quite what that's going to look like yet. But what slammed the brakes on here is that autism disclosure, that where this individual is saying, well, it's not that I'm rubbish at my job. It's not that I can't follow instructions. It's my condition that is meaning that I'm having trouble with what I'm doing. And therefore, you shouldn't be terminating my employment. You should be making reasonable adjustments. So that's the situation here that we are presented with and that we're going to try and unpick.
Okay. Immediately, I've certain alarm bells are ringing in my head, but we'll discuss that as we go. HR perspective first. When an employee is incapable of doing the simplest of tasks, is it a capability issue?
So arguably, yes. And just because somebody has got a disability, which is what we're talking about here, when we're talking about autism, ADHD, and neurodiverse conditions, they are either potentially or likely to meet the definition under the Equality Act. It doesn't mean that we can't terminate someone's employment on the basis of capability. It just means that we have got to make sure that we have considered the application of reasonable adjustments to level that playing field. So there's a couple of legal principles we need to touch on there. Firstly, definition of disability. We've got a mental or physical condition, so where we're talking about neurodiverse, it's a mental condition, that has or is likely to last more than 12 months. So these conditions generally are considered to be permanent.
It's a lifelong thing, isn't it?
Yeah, lifelong. And they've then got to have a substantial impact on someone's ability to undertake day-to-day activities. So when we're talking about neurodiverse conditions, it's that final bit of the test, which is where we're going to have the potential arguments. There's no argument it's condition. There's no argument it's likely to be long term. It's that whether it's got that substantial impact on someone's ability to undertake day-to-day activities. Now, we're not talking about situations where it enhances someone's ability to undertake activities. It's generally a detriment or a negative ability to be able to undertake them. So when we're talking about something that's neurodiverse, it might be that someone can't interpret information in a certain way. Perhaps they might have concentration issues. There's a huge spectrum of challenges that people who are neurodiverse will experience. And particularly when we're looking at roles where there's a need for lots of information to be absorbed very quickly, and perhaps that information is coming in a very strict or rigid way, where there isn't that kind of flexibility for that to be tailored, is that we may then see someone who's got a neurodiverse condition experiencing a challenge, which we've got in this situation. And as I've said, that doesn't mean that we can't necessarily go down a capability route. So you identified that straight off, capability, someone struggling because of performance, one of our five fair reasons for dismissal is capability. But if someone is disabled under the Equality Act and meets that definition, we have an obligation to implement reasonable adjustments to try and give that person equal access to the workplace and to be able to give them the chance to perform. Now, it might be there's no reasonable adjustments. It might be no matter what we do, we can't level that playing field. Or what we put in place, it might not just get us far enough and there's nothing else that we can do. In those circumstances, we can then look at a capability dismissal. So that's kind of the legal context that we're looking at in a situation like this.
Capability-based. Speaking from experience, I've obviously worked in like second-line support.
Well, do you want to explain what second-line support is? Because for me, it's something that, it's a concept that's very new to me.
Okay.
in the legal world, it's not something we do. So tell us what your job is, Ollie. What do you do?
Right. So historically speaking, I dealt with second and third-line support issues. First line is like, people tell you there's a problem, you respond. They might give you some details. You're basically just finding stuff out. Second line is like, I'm not going to say like more codey stuff, but like I'm more familiar with like Python and SQL and like the back end stuff, like the stuff that makes web pages look the way they do. We're more familiar with that stuff, integrations and stuff.
So you've got a mix of the customer service and then the codey techie stuff in the background. You mesh the two.
Yeah, exactly that. But it's less of the customer facing stuff. First line's all that, just talking to customers. Second line's like mainly investigation stuff, which is like why I said earlier, like I think I said alarm bells are ringing in my head a bit, because I would think that kind of role would suit a lot of people who were on the spectrum, to say, because it's very like in the trenches, some customer facing stuff, but mainly like digging into like the reasoning behind things. But I appreciate it's a sliding scale, isn't it, and not everyone's the same. But yeah, that's essentially what second line support is. Very strange situation we find ourselves in. Second question, when should HR step in and how should they approach the situation?
So HR really should be involved super early in this sort of situation. Now, if the employee has diagnosed prior to starting, if they've disclosed prior to starting that they are suffering with a condition, they don't even necessarily need to say, I've got a disability. It could just be, I've got a condition that I need to tell you about. HR should be involved from the off. So coordinating those meetings, or maybe having those meetings, facilitating those meetings between line manager and employee, talking about what their needs, their wants, their wishes are, maybe going through the job description with them, what the role profile looks like, what the day-to-day duties look like, establishing where the difficulties might be and starting that exercise around reasonable adjustments, what accommodations can be made. Now, there is no requirement for an employee to disclose a disability before they start. I get asked this all the time. So you'll have someone who's been in employment, they get to 6 month probation, they realize they're about to fail it, and they disclose and say, I have a disability. An employer will ring me up and go, but they're dishonest. They were dishonest when we recruited them because they didn't tell us. Or we sent them a medical form and they didn't put that they had a disability on it. And I go, so?
They didn't have to.
There is no obligation for them to disclose at any point.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
That they have a disability.
I don't, to be fair, because it's like allergies and stuff.
Yeah, well,
it's pointless.
I mean, you disclose everything, Ollie. Literally. I don't think there's anything regarding your day-to-day challenges that we don't know about wheat. You're nice and open, which means then when I buy, for example, Easter eggs for the team, I know to check the box.
Yes, you do.
It's a reasonable adjustment that I make for you, Ollie.
Yes. But
I make sure that your Easter egg isn't going to poison you. So there's no obligation for someone to say that, which is why when I speak to sometimes some quite irate line managers, and they'll say, well, hang on, they're just playing the disability card. They know they're going to get dismissed. So they're bringing it up at this point. They haven't mentioned it before now. So surely we can just crack on. No, we can't.
It's happened a lot. Like
this happens.
People save that card for...
Whether they're saving it or... I mean, I'm split on this because... You know, these people, they are fighting for their jobs. Nobody wants to be dismissed.
That's true, yeah, true.
And sometimes, even if someone is prepared to accept that a job isn't right for them, they might not have another job to go to.
Clinging
to
their life.
Clinging on, you know? And that's a very human and very natural reaction. So I'm always of the view, we've got to strip the anger out of this. This is someone who is desperately fighting for their job. You know, they might have a mortgage. They might have... kids. They might have a wife who either doesn't work or is a stay-at-home mom, or perhaps she's just lost her job or he's just lost his job. You know, there's no accounting for the personal situation where someone loses a job and they don't have anything else to go to. So I get the frustration that someone feels like, right, I've got the way out of this situation where we've had what we think is a bad hire and something's put the brakes on it, to have that very natural reaction where they go, you know, this is just someone who is being awkward. Well, they're not being awkward. And the fact that they've chosen when they're going to disclose this, yes, it can be frustrating that we didn't have that knowledge earlier on, that we didn't have that opportunity support or to put those adjustments in place. But we have to react appropriately at that point. So really, yes, we are putting the brakes on. We are going to explore reasonable adjustments. Mm-hmm. We are going to look at whatever else we can do. It doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to duplicate that probation process. So say if you've got someone on a 6-month probation, they get to the end. It doesn't mean we're necessarily going to do another 6 months. We might put a performance improvement plan in place with specific targets, with reasonable adjustments, and we're going to track it. We're going to see, do things get better with adjustments in place? And if they don't, then we'll review the situation and we can look at dismissal again. But yes, it is seen as a card. And it's...
That's how I initially, when you said it, my brain went card.
That is the knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? Is that they are playing this card. My response to that is there isn't some benefit to the employee from having hidden it.
No.
You know, they probably haven't had a great time at work for 6 months.
Maybe they don't want to be judged. Do you know what I mean?
Might not want to be judged. Might not want to disclose it. They might have had a very poor experience in previous employment where they have disclosed it. So there's many, many, many reasons why an employee might not disclose what's going on with them. Yes, so they might have been in a job where actually it never presented an issue before. They've changed working environments and now it does. It could be that their condition is going through some sort of change or evolution. Perhaps they've had a change in treatment, a change in medication.
Mm-hmm. There's variables, isn't there?
There can be many, many reasons why somebody won't disclose it. So we've got to get away from that, oh, they're playing the disability card.
It's almost prejudice.
It's 100%.
Isn't
because
it?
It's an immediate negative reaction to someone disclosing disability.
I've got to stop doing that.
I mean, it's probably disability discrimination, Ollie.
I've got to stop doing that.
Yeah.
It's why you do that and I do this.
Yeah, that's exactly why I do this. It's... Yes, it can be frustrating. Yes, it can be seen as a way of... And look, I have dealt with situations where I have suspected that someone has done it to prolong their employment, where they have been through, when you look at their CV, periods of employment that vary from 4 months to 12 in a series of employments. There's a pattern. And knowing that if they get to the point of probation failure, they disclose it, they're going to buy themselves an extra 3 to 6 months.
Mm.
That means either they've got some extra pay coming in, or they can negotiate a settlement, or they've now got time to go and look for another job and they can move on to the next role. So I have no doubt that happens, but we can't judge everybody in the same way. We're all individuals. We all have our own reasons for doing what we do. And if we have an immediate negative reaction to a disclosure, we're going to be straight away potentially facing a discrimination claim.
And on that point, The next question. What are the risks of not accommodating neurodivergent employees? Are businesses liable for disability discrimination?
100%. So if you've got someone who's neurodiverse and we are not exploring reasonable adjustments, then we're staring down the barrel of a discrimination claim. Discrimination claims uncapped when it comes to compensation. So you can be looking at hundreds of thousands, millions.
So why are you saying that so flippantly?
Because I say it flippantly because employers don't take this seriously. And it's like, we see case after case after case hitting the press. And it's not even like it's big news anymore. Like, employers should all know this. They should all know that if you've got someone with a disability, that we have got obligations. There are things that we need to do. And also, not just around the way that line managers and HR treat people, they're colleagues. You know, you might have someone who goes into their probation meeting, they disclose they've got a neurodiverse condition, and line manager goes, mate, that it all makes sense. Right. Let's talk about reasonable adjustments. This is what we can do. Everyone comes out feeling really positive. HR has gone, yes, we've got this. There's no legal risk here. We're dealing with it properly. Person goes and sits down and the person next to them goes, Oi, what are you still doing here, idiot? You know, you can't control what the individuals are going to do. So we might do something perfectly at a management level, but because we haven't trained employees on appropriate behaviour, what it means to have a disability, about the world of reasonable adjustments, one of your employees could be the reason why you've got that legal risk. And we focus on line managers so much. We focus on HR. We focus on training senior management. But actually, the real risk is running around in the workforce because we haven't trained them appropriately.
The most flappy gun people are just your box level employees, aren't they? We don't know what we're saying.
100%.
We're getting
trouble.
Like
you were saying, what? When we talked about the disability card. There we go.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was saying.
You know, It's why, as a business, we're really passionate about training. But it's also why I'm so flippant when I talk about these hundreds of thousand pound awards, because we should all know about this stuff, but also we should know how to combat it. And one of the most effective ways of combating discrimination is through training your entire workforce.
This comes on the DEI.
DEI. So diversity, equity, inclusion. So it's not around political messaging. It's not around deciding whether DEI programs that have been withdrawn by the Trump administration or these large companies that say they're withdrawing their DEI program. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about, flashy programs or initiatives that are put in place so that we can get some sort of B Corp badge. What we're talking about when we talk about DEI is fundamentally training out negative behaviour. Mm-hmm. And if we can't train it out, that because we have told someone how we expect them to behave, if they don't follow the rules, they are liable to be dismissed.
So they're on the neck and not the business.
Exactly. So it's around mitigating our legal risk for the business. Mm-hmm. It's not about political programmes. And that's the focus that I take with my advice, but also with the training that I deliver. And it's why we designed our D&I training, the e-learning, in the way that we did. It's around minimum standards of behaviour. It's around awareness. So that when you pull in the idiot who sat next to our employee and gone, what are you still doing here? That he knows it's not acceptable to treat people with, you know, less than the minimum standard of dignity. That you can't pick on people or single them out because of their differences.
No, it's not good culture anyway, is it?
No, it's dreadful for culture.
I'm always pushing the envelope as such in the way I speak to not a certain person in the workplace.
Our dear leader.
Yes. But I like to think certain people can handle it. Do you know what I mean? There's a gauge to be had.
But yeah.
There's a line as well. Like, I wouldn't overstep certain.
So the gauge and the line are going to be different for everybody.
Yes.
And this is where the dreaded banter word comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that actually in one of our shorts videos that I've actually, Dawn, you'd be happy to know, did this morning. I met one of my content obligations. So we had two cases recently where company has gone down on disability discrimination. One, because one colleague called another Darth Vader.
For what reason, if you might don't mind me asking?
He said it was banter, but it was meant in a negative way. And the judge accepted this.
Okay.
It was a negative thing to say because Darth Vader is a baddie.
He's a bad boy. Yeah,
he's not a goodie. Okay. It wasn't a very nice thing to say. And the reason why I'm talking about this in a juvenile way is because it's primary school stuff.
Yeah, it sounds
You know, it's would I go home and cry myself to sleep because someone called me Darth Vader? Probably not. Would I consider wearing all black to work again the next day? Probably not.
I would.
Would you just play up? Yeah. You'd come in with the mask over your face and...
Bad guy here, what's up?
Yeah, there you go. Kind of thing. So, yeah, strange. We had guy who's called Darth Vader. And then there was another one where there was a specific finding in relation to sighing. So sighing, in an exaggerated way, was considered to be negative behaviour. So when someone goes, oh,
God.
That was enough.
We'd be finished.
That was enough. Yeah, exactly. So when you talk about the gauge and the line and banter, that's such dangerous territory.
Mm.
Because what's okay with one person, if you sighed and rolled your eyes at me, would I think twice about it? No. Would somebody else? Yes, could be deeply offended.
God, crazy world we live in, isn't it, really?
Yeah, so it's a lot of trust we're placing in employees to know each other well enough to know where the line is mm-hmm. and where the gauge is. Yes, some banter can be very, very, very heavy-handed. Other people, no, banter's an absolute no-go and it makes them feel very uncomfortable. And we have to remember we're in a workplace environment. It's not okay to judge someone for their banter tolerances because it's not a thing. Judges don't like banter. Does that mean that the workplace is becoming a bit boring and a bit over-sanitized? It's something that I've commented on in one of the shorts that will eventually make its way to LinkedIn, is that we're taking the human out of human resources. Are we just becoming, you know, a bit robotic in the way that, you know, we can't express any personality? Are we making that bar so very low in terms of tolerance for, you know, maybe an anecdotal or a throwaway comment? Now, I do not agree that banter is an excuse for bullying, or that it is an excuse for getting around sexual harassment or DE&I. I don't think sexually related banter is okay. I don't think banter related to protected characteristics is okay. But I think if someone makes a throwaway comment about someone calls them Darth Vader, is that worse?
God, was it just because they're wearing black clothes?
I don't know what. You know what? I should probably actually read the case in detail. But, no, there was a wider pattern of behaviour. But what got me in this one was the judge made a finding on that specific fact that the law was broken. Are we really in a position where we need to be asking a judge, is that a breach of the law? Or actually, is it enough just to haul someone in front of HR and go, back off him and leave him alone
pack
a bit?
That in, yeah.
Just pack it in. Yeah. Why is it not okay that we can't just address the behaviour that way? How is it that this sort of behaviour is making its way into the courts?
I think it's a waste of judges' time, me, that kind of thing.
It's like, stuff
that
we
you can deal with.
It's,
you know,
yeah,
I mean?
It's something we should be getting to grips with in workplaces. There is no reason why this should be escalating into a situation where we're in a full-blown tribunal. We should be getting to grips with this stuff. We should be managing our risk internally. We should be training people. We should be getting to know our workforce. And where we're seeing behaviour start to impact somebody, we're putting a stop to it. And it is a minefield. Who would want to own a business in a world where someone lost a tribunal because they were sighed at?
That's wild.
You know, it is wild.
Have you got a figure for that? Like how much money they got?
Oh, we're talking thousands. You know, we're not talking like a few hundred quid. It is crackers, for lack of a better term. But in the same vein, you know, if I was arguing this from the other side, we'd say, where do we draw the line? Either banter is okay or no, it's not. And if we're saying no banter is okay, you don't call people but got Darth Vader at work.
God, I just think it...
It's a minefield.
I know where you're coming from, but I just think it sets you up for a real stiff workplace environment.
It does. And that's one of the things I really like about our workplace is we've all got to know each other well enough that we can have inoffensive, and I think that's the point, is that we're not offensive. We can have an inoffensive, positive workplace where it isn't all a bit stiff. But you can't trust that everyone will do that. And when you think about other workplaces, you might think about some of the people that you've worked with mm-hmm. in the past. Would you trust that every single one of them would know where the line is?
No.
Which is why training is so important.
Yeah, I've got examples of that, but we'll save it for another day. We need to get some employee perspective built into this, don't we, really? We've got a couple of questions. If the company promotes flexible working, why is working at night a problem?
So in this situation, the chap had the ability to work either as and when he wanted, because I don't think he was entirely customer facing. So depending on what he was doing, could resolve stuff round the clock. Mm-hmm. Now, with other employees, that wasn't a problem. With this one, because the output wasn't good.
Low output.
Quality of. So I don't think he was actually resolving what customers were raising and then was marking things as complete. There was no supervision, there was no oversight. And because nobody else was working at that time, he kind of had a bit of a free rein and this was all going a bit unchecked.
Right, okay.
So then what was happening is morning shift were coming on to a range of irate customers saying, well, they've said this has been resolved. However, now it's all fallen over and nothing's working.
Mm.
Because there was no oversight because of the hours that he was working.
He was putting people back in square one, essentially, for what he was doing.
Like square minus two. Okay, like worse situations than what was originally presented. Yeah, yeah. So it's not that... It probably was an instance, actually, where flexible working wasn't working. And that a reasonable adjustment in this instance might be that he's working when there is a supervisor, line manager, you know, peer review able to work so mm-hmm. that he can work with somebody else, check his understanding of something before he then launches in and does like 14 hours of coding.
Well, that was what shadowing was for. Like when I first started on support, I had a guy called Charlie check my answers before mm-hmm. I sent them. Like, you know,
Charlie check my answers. I like that.
He was part Ukrainian, a very interesting surname. But yeah, check my answers before. I'd note them up. Add it as a note, he'd go and tick it, like yes, or change it a bit, then I'd send it. Which I think is like this natural progression of how you integrate into a role. But this guy had clearly just gone off on his own sort of tangent. And
I think there probably is a situation where we can have too much flexibility. So, and the temptation here is for company to go, we have this wonderful reasonable adjustment we've applied. We've let him work flexibly so he can work how he wants. Is that a reasonable adjustment that's going to reduce the detriment that he is experiencing? It's not.
The interaction with the team will just go downhill.
Interaction with the team's going down. His understanding of what's being asked of him isn't being helped. So whilst the company might see this as a, you know, a tick box positive thing to do, if it doesn't remove, reduce, or mitigate the detriment, it's not a reasonable adjustment. It's not okay, it's not enough just to go, well, we've given you lots of good things. Lots of good things.
It needs to be specific.
It's got to be specific. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do is think about, right, what is the difficulty this person is facing? What are the challenges? And what can we put in place that is going to change that specific situation that's going to make this easier, this better, reduce that challenge? Because if we're not going through that exercise and we've just got a scattergun approach of, well, here's a load of lovely stuff, take your pick, That's not reducing the detriment.
Chances are he's going to take Michael a bit. Do you know what I mean? And pick loads of things that he wants to do.
Potentially. Benefit him, yeah. But it's not going to meet the legal requirement of a reasonable adjustment if it's not leveling the playing field.
Okay.
That is the whole point of the reasonable adjustment exercise. And it's where companies fall down is they have missed that step where someone's gone, I've got a disability, and they go, great, here's a load of reasonable adjustments without actually working out what detriment these adjustments are addressing.
It's quite lazy.
It's a bit lazy, but I think potentially it's also a misunderstanding of the legal test. Because okay, for a reasonable adjustment, you've either got to have a physical barrier in the workplace that's causing the person with a disability an issue, and you've got to look at a way of alleviating that physical barrier. So say, for example, if you've got somebody with mobility issues, and the example I always give to clients is the big car park, and you make people park right at the end because there's no disabled spaces. The physical disadvantage is the distance that person's got to cover, that it's going to cause either injuries to their hands if they're on crutches, or potentially going to make them late or tired for work by the time they actually get in. The reasonable adjustment would be parking space by the door.
Yeah.
So we've got physical barrier. The adjustment specifically addresses that. So that's one. We've then got one where if someone is facing a difficulty and it can be alleviated through auxiliary aids, then that is an adjustment we should be applying. So say, for example, you have got someone who has, as a result of a condition, sensitivity to the light on a computer screen, or the way, you know, the way that they look at screens. You can get various screen covers, filters, or perhaps if they have issues with written information, you can look at auditory software, that sort of thing. So auxiliary aids in that sense. And then the third one is a PCP. So we've talked about this on pods before, the procedure, policy, or criterion that places someone at a disadvantage. So if we have a policy of where people aren't performing that we will dismiss them for capability. That's acceptable to have that policy. If someone has a disability, that places them at a disadvantage compared to other people. They are more likely to fail that policy. They are more likely to lose their employment because their disability means their capability is going to be in question. So how do we apply a reasonable adjustment to that? We might allow a longer period for their performance to be assessed. We might provide them with some assistance in their role. So we've got to identify what is it that they're struggling with. It triggers the obligation then for that, for the reasonable adjustment. And what are we putting in place to alleviate that disadvantage?
Last question from an employee perspective before we sort of close out. If I don't pass my probation, but I've disclosed my neurodivergence and asked for support, do I have grounds to challenge the outcome legally?
Potentially, yes. So my best practice is always, even if someone's got less than 2 years service, that we still give them the right to appeal. So you would have the right to challenge at your appeal stage in that situation. When employment rights bill comes in, we're going to have the day one employment rights. So right of appeal should be baked in, which is why, you know, the advice I'm giving now is every single dismissal, go through the full procedure if you're an employer. So that really does become baked into your organization. But yes, if you've been dismissed on the grounds of capability or performance, you've disclosed a disability which has directly impacted your performance.
At any point,
there's been no adjustments that have been made, then potentially that person would have a disability discrimination claim. Now, just because they've disclosed a disability doesn't necessarily mean it's automatic they'd have a claim. It's got to have impacted their performance.
Right.
Okay. If the disability has got absolutely nothing to do with how they're performing at work, totally unrelated, then we haven't got the detriment because of that disability. It hasn't triggered the requirement for reasonable adjustments.
Okay.
It's not just a case of, I've got a disability, therefore I get my gold-plated protection in all circumstances.
It has to be applicable to...
It's got to be applicable to, to their performance and to their capability. But we're not doctors as employers. So if someone discloses something and we think, well, that's totally unrelated and we've got it wrong, then we're definitely going to be on the hook, which is where things like occupational health come in. It's why we have meetings with employees where we'll say, okay, tell me about the challenges that you're facing. We've got to understand in the most basic terms how their disability impacts them at work and what the challenges are that they face. If we make assumptions are dangerous, we're probably going to end up in tribunal. And given the prevalence now of what we're seeing in terms of neurodiverse diagnosis, this is something that every employer needs to be aware of. Every employer needs to, as a matter of course, every single year do DE&I training. Because if we're not catching every employee, if we're not training all of them every year, making sure that we're not having skill fade, people understand these concepts and they're familiar with them, every single employee walking around your business could be a potential walking tribunal claim.
Landmines everywhere, isn't
it? It's a lot of risk. And I had a statistic from The Guardian.
Oh, go on.
So it's from a 2021 study. So this is actually out of date now. There was a 787% rise in the number of diagnoses between 1998 and 2018 in the UK for autism.
I want to swear, but to
it's
exclaim.
Huge.
But, that's a lot.
Huge increase. And actually, I would say since 2021, even more so.
Oh, 100%, yeah. 100%.
So if you're an employer, do you have the confidence that everybody in your workplace won't put their foot in it? That they are not going to be the ones that mean that you as a business end up in a tribunal and answering to a discrimination claim? If you can't say yes, if you can't with confidence say, everyone in my workforce, I know, wouldn't say or do the wrong thing.
Buy our training.
Buy our training. If you think that everybody would and you've never trained them, if you think everybody fine, you've never done any training, I'd say you're a really, really naive business owner.
You've seen the best
That's,
in people.
There's the reality check coming from someone who does this day to day. You have to train your workforce. You have to. It's the only way that you can reduce that legal risk to be able to say to a judge, look, judge, we should not be liable for the actions of this individual. Because we trained them, we taught them about the minimum standards of behavior. They did it anyway, so we disciplined them and dismissed them. I'm not responsible for the behavior of that person.
Get yourself off the hook.
That's what we want to be able to be doing, so that we're not on, you know, facing 100, 200,000 pounds worth of compensation claims.
Uncapped. Yeah. Especially if you're a big business and there's a lot of these little heathens running around spreading.
There are.
Un-D&I checked things around.
It's true. Because when I spoke to someone from our sales team and the response that they sometimes get, and invariably, I mean, I'm going to be really stereotypical here, male business leaders who will say, oh, I don't need any of that rubbish in my workforce.
Oh.
And you just think, well, if you're not going to buy the training, you're going to be paying a lawyer to clean it all up anyway. So at least we're supporting the legal industry.
Dearie me.
But it's, yeah, this lack of awareness and this kind of really, really stubborn response to, we're not going woke in my business. It's not about being woke. It's about training minimum standards of behaviour so that your staff aren't pushing other people around because of disability.
My mate hates it. It's like, you see, people say that about anything now.
Yeah.
About anything. It can apply to anything. It's such a loose description for something that doesn't sort of apply to old white men methods.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I think so anyway.
And it is. It's that framing of what some segments of society are perceiving to be modern thinking where everyone's oversensitive.
Mm.
And like I said at the beginning, you know, this isn't about political programs. It's not about making political statements. It's not about defending people who are too insensitive. It's about insulating your business against legal risk so that your business can go on into 2026, 2027, so that you can retire, exit, get bought out, you know, plan for your family, your future. Are you prepared to hang the future of your family, the future of your business, the income of everybody who works for you on the stubborn concept that I'm not prepared to engage in training people on the minimum standards of behaviour?
It's unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you want to skin the cat, it's the way the world is now, isn't it? We've got to follow suit. Key themes, what happened here and personal perspective perhaps?
So ultimately the individual was dismissed on the grounds of capability. So reasonable adjustments were applied. There was no improvement. It was the wrong job for the wrong person. Not so much even around the communication stuff and the ticketing. The quality of the coding was bad.
Right, okay.
It wasn't up to the level of sort of developer expertise,
right,
should we say, that was required. Yet to see if tribunal proceedings get brought, relatively recent. But I have to say, I'm probably dealing with 15 to 20 similar scenarios at the moment.
Rife.
Across our client base. Yeah, it is rife at the moment. It really, really is a common issue.
I mean, you mentioned it earlier, but I feel like even though he went about it in a strange way, Donald Trump has put DEI on like the map. Because of how dismissive he was of it.
And I'm surprised the number of people who don't know what DE&I stands for.
Yeah, crazy that.
Diversity, equity, inclusion, guys. There we go.
Crazy. A bit of me, to be fair, for a while thought that E was equality.
So that is a common, I mean, some people do talk about diversity, equality and inclusion.
Do they mean similar things?
They're two different concepts. Okay. So equality is where we treat everybody the same. Mm-hmm. So we apply the same treatment to everybody. Equity is where we level the playing field. So there's a little graphic. It's where you've got people of different heights and they're trying to reach apples on a tree. So treat everybody with equality. We put them all on the same size box. The little person still can't reach the apple. Mm. They're getting the same amount of help as the very tall person, but the very tall person now can reach lots of apples.
Yes.
Because they've been given the extra step up. Treat people with equity, the smallest person gets the biggest box to stand on. They get additional help.
Okay.
But it means that at the end, they're all at the same height and they can all access the apples on the tree.
That's a really good metaphor, you know. I will remember that.
Yeah. So I train about equity. So it's around leveling that playing field, the discrimination stuff really comes in.
Nice.
So there we go. Now you know the difference.
I know the difference.
Just reinforcing that point around the training, really, isn't it? Mm-hmm. What we've found is when companies realise what it is that we're actually training on, they love it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can really, really see the business benefit, the risk reduction side of things. And these pods aren't about plugging, you know, it's talking about these real world scenarios and how we unpick situations. But it's... The reason why it's so key is that we can't just focus on the line managers. We've got to think about that wider workforce and the risks they represent. And it's such an easy fix.
It's a cultural thing, isn't it? By and large.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for your time. Like, comment, subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Until next time, we're your hosts signing off from HRER. Take care of your HR and may your workplace be disaster-free. Before we go, a big thank you to you for tuning in and don't forget to subscribe. If you have your own ER stories or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us at Heroes or on social media, or even HRER@heroes.co.uk. As we navigate the maze of workplace blunders, remember that no organisation is perfect. But by sharing these stories, we can all work towards creating healthier, happier, and more productive workplaces.